Well, hello there. I'm Adrian Warnock, and I'm joined here by Professor Peter Hillman. Now, Peter Hillman should be well known to most people in the blood cancer community, as he's probably the most influential, certainly one of the most influential CLL doctors, particularly in the UK and also internationally as well. And Peter heads up runs the FLAIR trial, which many of us have heard of, and some of us on. It's something that's talked about a lot in some of the forums. So, Peter, first of all, could you just greet us and tell us a little bit about where we are with the FLAIR trial? Because that should be a great place to start, perhaps.
Yeah, thanks, Adrian. Yeah, so the FLAIR trial has been ongoing now since 2014. We started the first part of it, and we've now got just around 1,400 patients around the UK in FLAIR. It's going very strongly until we ran into the COVID-19 pandemic. So we're almost finished recruiting the trial, another 100 and so patients to go, although we are extending it to add in another cohort of patients who got 17 PD lesions, so poorest patients, which will be interesting, I think. The COVID crisis, unfortunately, has virtually stopped recruitment for a period of time, although it's now picking up as we come through the back of that. I guess we expect the first results from FLAIR maybe next year. I mean, it's dependent on the outcome and of the patients, and so we're waiting until we can report the first data. So we're doing a lot of work on it at the moment, preparing for that, getting all the if you like, the ducks in a row, so that when we get the results, we've got it all sorted out. So.
I mean, anecdotally, I guess I'm hearing that people are doing quite well on each of the different sorts of treatments, whether inside there or outside there. I mean, is it ever a worry that everything will just be so good that there won't be any difference found?
Well, that's really the challenge with CLL. It's a nice challenge to have, I guess, is that the therapies, even the control arms in trials, are very effective. So, you know, we're looking at, with FCR, when we do trials, we have to compare against a standard, and the standard for us at the now still, but maybe it's disappearing, hopefully, is FCR for younger patients. And of course, one of the good things about FCR is that the average time until the patient progresses is years. And so therefore, to beat that, you have to follow the patients for years on the new therapies. And so we're almost a sort of victim of our own success in some respect. Although if our aim is to cure and to get away from chemotherapy, then the trials like FLAIR have to be very large, which is why we have a large trial, and we have to follow them for a long time, which is what we're doing.
Yeah. So one of the things I noticed in the recent virtual posters that were released for the ASCO was, I think, two different epidemiological studies, and then I found a third one online just recently that was published, I think, in the British Journal of Cancer, and they all suggest that for most blood cancers, and in particular, I think two of the three of those were just focused on CLL, that life expectancy is really going up in, I guess, the decades that you've been working. Because, I mean, how long have you, sorry, don't want to highlight how old you are here, Peter, but you've been working in this field for quite a while, haven't you? Is it true to say that people are living longer now?
Yeah, the first trials I led were in the mid-90s, so we've been so working hard since then. I think the last 10 years for CLL has been dramatic changes. I mean, we had, when I started, I qualified in medicine in the mid-80s, and then we had one or two treatments for diseases like CLL, which were very ineffective, really. And we've since then gone through the era of fludarabine and combinations, and if you like, getting the best out of chemotherapy, which I guess FCR does, we can't really maximize it any more than that. We tried. That was the first big step forward, and then that was probably in the sort of 2000s probably. And then really since 2010 and onwards, we've had ibrutinib and venetoclax and a series of new therapies coming through that really have had a major impact on outcome for patients. And what you have to remember is that the outcome that were, if you're thinking about a 10-year survival, you're therefore talking about therapies that were given 10 years ago, not the ones that we're using now. And so the looking at the outcomes of our patients now, the survival is probably very close to the normal population, I would say. You know, I can remember the era of going through ineffective trials where we you know, if someone had failed chemotherapy, the outcome is very poor. And, you know, by nature, we took many patients to transplant if they were fit for that. And now we rarely see the resistant patients in that way, and we take very few patients to transplant. That doesn't mean we don't need that therapy, and doesn't mean that, you know, in the future we won't use intense treatments, but it shows you the change.
Yeah, so, I mean, let's just back up for a second, because one of the things I'm trying to do with some of these interviews is make sure that people who don't know so much would understand. So, I mean, there's a few things about getting a blood cancer diagnosis, particularly if it's one of the more chronic or slow-growing or indolent, some people say, like CLL, but also like some of the others, is that people say to you, yeah, you've got blood cancer, you know, maybe you've got cancer in every drop of blood in your body, but we don't want to treat you. And for some people, it can be like, in my case, it was 16 months or something like that. But in other cases, it can be like 16 years or more before someone even needs treatment. So why is that? Because I think that's something that people often find. And I'm just thinking there might be somebody watching this right now who, who's just been told that and is like, whoa, I want you to cut it out. Get it out of me.
No, it's a very, you know, we're sort of educated by through the media and through all we hear that if you have a cancer, you catch it early, you treat it early, and the outcome is better. And for many cancers, that is the case. But in the case of leukemia, and certainly CLL, that's is not the case. So we're seeing probably, for our patients with CLL, 90% of the patients who when they're diagnosed, is almost an incidental finding, a blood count for preoperative or some other reason, and they find a high lymphocyte count. So it isn't just that there's a delay to treatment, but half of those patients will never go on to need treatment. And so if you think about it, if we treat every patient as they present, we're going to be treating half the patients and with all the side effects, even with the new therapies, there are going to be side effects that we're exposing patients to that will never need therapy. So that's the first thing I'd say. The second thing, I guess, is if you look at CLL is a disease really of our immune system getting a bit old and a bit tired, I'm afraid. And we look at that, and we see our cells occur in a high proportion, relatively high proportion of people generally. So when we look, we did a research study some years ago, 20 years ago now, looking at people with normal blood counts, and 6% of patients with normal blood count, 6% of people with normal blood counts at the age of 60 have CLL cells. So CLL cells are a very common, phenomenon, but they rarely go on to lead to leukemia. So most of the patients we're picking up are very early. Now, and the final thing I'd say is that as we get more effective therapies, and we are getting more effective therapies, then they're more effective regardless of whether you treat people early or treat people later. And so you don't want people to be symptomatic and to suffer from the leukemia, because we have effective ways of stopping that. But if people have no symptoms at all, they're not going to gain by treating patients early. And we have a number of studies that have shown that.
Yeah, and I think that's an interesting point, isn't it? Because it almost feels like, for some people, there's a window that starts to open where maybe treatment might be needed, might be sensible, especially if they're getting symptoms, but perhaps it's not so crucial. And then as time goes on, perhaps it becomes more crucial, and it's like, you know, you might be more insistent that treatment is needed. Is that a fair way of putting it?
I think, I'm not sure I'd quite put it in those ways. I think what I'd say is that a diagnosis of CLL, and stage A CLL, early stage CLL that we find incidentally, is obviously makes people very anxious, and it's something you don't want. It's not, you know, it's not a good thing to have. And so I'm not underplaying the significance of a diagnosis of CLL to an individual, because we all have a fear of leukemia and things like that. So I think that's really important. You know, we've got work showing that people's quality of life is poorer if they have a diagnosis such as CLL. Maybe just even the diagnosis is enough to do that.
Yeah.
I would say that over the years, when we had less effective therapies and more toxic therapies, there was a tendency to wait, because you didn't want to expose the patient to a toxic therapy, which could have some side effects and make the patient more ill to get better. And so And then an FCR is a good example of that. We tried not to give people FCR because we knew it was, you know, quite an ordeal for the patient. Mm. And then many patients over the years, eventually you treat them, and then they'd say, I've never felt, when they go in remission, they finish the treatment, they've not felt as well for 4 years. Well, that implies that maybe they should have been treated a bit earlier, because if they've now lived for 3 or 4 years with symptoms, which maybe they didn't need to have. And I suspect with the newer therapies as they come through, which we have less fear of, if you like, and although we have to respect them, that there's a tendency to, for those patients who have symptoms, to treat them when the symptoms are becoming significant to the patient.
And I guess symptoms-wise, what would be the main things that you see in your practice that people talk to you about?
Well, lethargy, tiredness is the main symptom that the patients will talk about. And that's, of course, that's a slow thing that, you know, if you start off with no symptoms, you don't suddenly become usually completely tired and you can't do anything. That generally builds up over months or even 1 or 2 years or longer. And so that's an insidious thing that and then patients tend to justify it and say, well, I'm getting older, and, you know, I'm going to be tired. Well, you know, you don't get older that quickly usually. And so, you know, CLR is often a component. And the sweats can be bad for some patients. They're rarer. I would say tiredness is more. The lymph glands, the actual presence of the lymph glands don't usually cause a problem, but some patients are disturbed by having skin glands, particularly if they're very large. So they're the main, and weight loss, I guess, is the other thing.
One of the things I wondered about is sometimes the rate of that growth important, because there are some people who go quite quick and some people go quite slow. And they talk about that certainly in terms of the problems with your bloods going up quite quickly, that can be associated with symptoms. But I'm guessing if a lymph node is growing fast, maybe there's a risk it might compress things a bit more or get in the way a bit more. Yeah. Does that something you see or not really?
Not very often, but it can be an issue. I mean, so I think that in terms of the dynamic of the disease, that's clearly the most important thing that will define whether a patient will need treatment in the future. You can't judge it over two different tests. So we always talk about blood counts to patients and the white cell count, and many patients get very preoccupied by what the level of the lymphocyte count is. Well, as a hematologist, as I said, doctor, you watch it over, you're looking at trends over a number of results rather than a single one. For example, if you get an infection, just an unrelated infection, the white cell can go up or can go down during the infection just because of a response to the infection, and then it'll settle down to its normal again. And so things can change the white cell count other than the disease. And likewise, lymph glands, they tend to grow slowly. So some patients will have lymph glands that sit around and don't do anything for years, and they'll very slowly increase and don't trouble them, in which case we wouldn't necessarily treat them. So I think the questions I tend to ask patients are, you know, what's the impact the symptoms is having on you? So are they stopping you doing things? Are you not going on holiday? You're not going out? Mm. You're in bed earlier than you did before? Those sorts of symptoms that, you know, that are having an impact on the quality of life and what people are doing, then become, to me, more important.
Yeah, and I guess that can be particularly perhaps an issue if you're younger and if you've still got a job. I mean, it's very strange for somebody like me at my age to have this disease, because I go to the conferences and I feel like the youngest person there, usually. I'm like the baby of the room. And now there are some people that are younger than me that have it. You know, I've even seen some people in their 20s, but it's often quite unusual. And yet, of course, you know, my father actually has a blood cancer. He doesn't mind me saying that. And for him, the fatigue that he experienced was less of a problem because he was already retired.
Yeah.
So, you know, he could adjust his lifespan a little bit. But for some people, you find yourself almost trapped with this dreadful fatigue that in some cases will stop you even working, or if not stop you working, limit your work. Mm-hmm. And yet many people find that some doctors, even I hate to say it, some hematologists, Peter, will actually say, no, it can't be your fatigue. You're not anemic. You can't be because of your cancer. It must be something else. And of course, we need to check for other things. Mm-hmm. But what would you say to people who've been told by doctors even that CLL doesn't cause fatigue unless you've got anemia?
Well, that's not the case. And it's clearly not the case. And I think as a doctor generally, not just a hematologist, you have to listen to your patients. And the patients generally obviously know their bodies better than we know them. And some people have, some individuals, not, you know, have the capacity to just, you know, don't have the same, the symptoms have the same impact on them as others do. And you know, I think you have to listen to patients. You have to exclude other causes. But the reality is, if you have, you know, CLL, you know, which is progressing, then tiredness is a very common, it's probably the most common symptom. And I think, you know, most patients, you don't initiate therapy on the basis of a single thing. You know, it's not the white count's gone up or the platelet count's gone down. It's a picture of tiredness increasing, white count going up, blood count's dropping, and multiple things usually. If I had a patient, for example, who, this is not very common, who has a very stable CLL and then develops tiredness, but there's no change in the CLL at all, then I would be worried that it wasn't the CLL that's causing it. Whereas if it's on the background of a white count doubling every 6 months or you know, some nose growing, then that almost certainly is the CLL.
So then let's just come back where we were before a little bit. So we were talking a little bit about treatment, and it's just interesting to me hearing a little bit about the development of the treatment, because from what I've read, and of course I'm not sure exactly where you came in, but you would have certainly seen some of this, I'm sure. Initially, the very first drugs were given on their own. So I think fludarabine was like given on its own. Is that right?
Yeah.
Cyclophosphamide was given on its own. Chemotherapy drugs. Yeah. Then they were given together, and then somebody came along with the first kind of wonder drug, really, the beginning of all this exciting immunotherapy, rituximab, where suddenly you've got a drug that actually kills lymphocytes rather than just almost any cell. And then, of course, they thought maybe we should put all three together, and so. Yeah. That then became the gold standard, in a sense. Okay. I mean, is that roughly speaking what happened? Have I got that roughly right?
Yeah, I think that's a reasonable. I think if you think of the biology of any disease like this, you know, there's very few leukemias, cancers that are effectively treated or cured by a single drug, because the leukemia cell in this case is trying to find a way around the. What we're doing to it, if you like, if you want to sort of give it a sort of ability to think, it's evolving around it, if you like. And so, and we see the same in infections and other things. So, you know, single agents, the tumor will try and become resistant. So the way you pin it down, if you like, is by hitting it in two or three different places so that you close off its escape route, if you like, so it can't get away from therapies. And if you achieve a deeper remission, so the other side of that is that you therefore achieve a deeper remission, we use MRD as one of our residual disease, then there's less disease there to develop resistance. More you've got there, the more resistance there's likely to be. So, and the other thing to remember is that the trials that we do are... There are several reasons that we do trials, and we being the whole sort of pharma and pharmaceutical industry and specialists, if you like. The first trials we do are to find the right dose and make sure that the drug has some chance of working and is safe. So that's a small number of patients that we do that study for. And we do many of those phase one, phase two trials. The second trials are to get to show a certain drug is effective. And so allow the drug company effectively to sell the drug, to make it available. And
that's usually one drug, isn't it, on its own? Well, sometimes it's one drug on its own.
Historically, you have to try and isolate that drug. So you have to show that particular drug has a benefit. So you can either have that drug versus another drug, or you can have two drugs and add a third drug to it and compare it to the two drugs. So you have to be able to show that individual drug is actually having a benefit, either alone or in combination. And then you have the big trials like FLIR, which take drugs that are approved and then try to use them in the best way. So you take the disease and say, okay, how do we best combine, you know, ibrutinib, venetoclax or whatever drugs we're using to effectively treat the disease. And they tend to be bigger trials, and they tend to be collaborative group studies like the ones like the UK group, because you know, you might have two or three drug companies who naturally would compete with each other, and where they rightly want to use both of your drugs together, and so it comes to us. So there's a lot of so that's the sort of natural history, and I think I believe that we will cure, and we are probably curing a proportion of patients with CLL, and we've got to increase that proportion. Stopping therapy and the disease not coming back. And if we're going to do that, we're going to do it by combining effective therapies in a logical way.
So in a way, we're almost going back to the future, aren't we? And we're almost rebuilding, if you like, the new FCR with all these different building blocks and going, what combination is going to work? We know now that these drugs work on their own, but what will work? You know, will it be better to have drug A and drug B and to know about sequencing as well? And I guess that's part of the issue with Flare. I mean, I've obviously got personal investment in it because I'm a patient in Flare, and you know, I look at it and now and I think, well, okay, so I've had, you know, what I've had. Will it actually make a difference if when I relapse at some point in the future, hopefully not for a long time, but when I do, that I then move on to a different drug? Will that sequence matter, or will it not actually matter in the long run? And I guess that's one of the questions you'd be able to answer in a very long time, because there's some good data that people do well after, you know, second treatments, certainly, maybe not fifth treatments, but second treatments.
So I think what's changed as well is our understanding of disease generally. And so we now, you know, when we started out, we didn't know the whole genome or much about the why leukemias and CLL in this case develop and what the problem with the cells is. And so I think FCR is probably fair to say FCR is the first combination where there was a logical reason why you'd combine the drugs. That, you know, they weren't just randomly put together. They were designed to work. The diamond and cyclosamide should work together for a variety of reasons. One damages the DNA and the leukemia, the other one stops it repairing it. So there's a logical combination. And then we talked about adding something else, which is a different way of working. And so that's FCR now with ibrutinib and venetoclax, and the future drugs coming along, and our CAR-Ts and all the other new therapies that are coming, they're based on a deep understanding of the biology of the disease, and that allows you to then make much more logical combinations, not only combinations of the drugs, but the timing of the combinations. So when's the best time to do these combinations? And alongside that, we have better ways to assess response. So you know, if we can measure one cell in 100,000, which we can now, that gives us a much more robust way to assess the depth of remission in a patient and by combinations. So not only do we move forward by logical combinations, we move forward by being able to assess those combinations better.
Right. Now, of course, right now we have a group of patients who've still had or are still having chemo or had it in the last few years. We've got a group of patients who are perhaps having venetoclax, maybe with rituximab or obinutuzumab. Mm-hmm. And again, in a sense, it's the same philosophy that you just described to try and, if you can, wipe it out or get as close to wiping out as possible. You talked about MRD negative, where you're saying that the disease can't be really detected anymore. You said you'd look at 100,000 cells and couldn't see any, and you'd go, great. But then there's a very different sort of thing as well, because there's a whole group of patients on either ibrutinib or acalabrutinib, and they don't usually get to this eradication, and yet they do very well. So could you just explain that a little bit? And how do you choose between that philosophy as you're a patient? I mean, you're sitting there, perhaps at your first choice, and maybe you're given the choice. I know it depends on the country whether you get that choice and the indication and all the rest of it. But let's say you have got that choice. If you like, not so much between the drugs, but between the philosophy of wipe it out, or I guess maybe put it in reverse a bit and suppress it, but not wipe it out. What's your thinking on that?
So I think you can look at it. There's several ways you can answer that question. First of all, you know, many of the diseases we treat, we control rather than cure. So high blood pressure, diabetes, or whatever other disease wants to do. And that's an effective strategy for many diseases. And we know that, you know, understanding the biology of CLL, that treatments like acalabrutinib, ibrutinib, those sorts of therapies switch off the growth of the cell. And that's an effective way of controlling the disease. Isn't going to eradicate the disease, but it stops it growing, which is the critical part of those therapies. And you know, the patients do go into remission because the cells aren't growing anymore. But if you stopped it, eventually the disease would come back. Now, that actually is a strategy we're now planning to look at in one of our trials. That, you know, can we stop it and then restart it several years later. And so that's one strategy. And it may well be that you mentioned age before, if you're sort of in your 70s or 80s and 10 or 15 years control of a disease might be very acceptable, and and actually having relatively few side effects, not having to go to hospital very often, taking a tablet may be a very good approach for you or for anyone, not age specific. There's that side of things. And then maybe there are certain disease types of CLL that, sort of markers within the CLL that say, okay, well, this is a type of CLL we can cure. So therefore, we will give chemotherapy to, for example. One type, we can't cure this type, therefore why would we expose them to the risk of chemotherapy, and we're looking at that in combinations as well. So I think that has an impact. And then by and large, and this may change, the therapies that eradicate disease, that get into deep remissions, are more intense. Certainly with chemotherapy they were, and with the combinations with venetoclax and ibrutinib, they're more intense, and so there's a price to pay, to get to deep remissions. And we don't know, the honest answer is we don't know. There isn't a one approach that's right for everyone, is the answer. So we have to select it, and in trials we will learn. Maybe in five, as you said, the problem is that with 5 or 10 years' time, we're about to say, okay, well, this is a better approach. Treat someone aggressively, intensely rather than aggressively, get them to deep remission, stop therapy, and then see what happens in 5, 10 years' time. And then we actually, because the therapies are moving forward so quickly, we'll have much better therapies even then than we do. And so I think we have to make a decision. So the things that help, availability of therapy, obviously, but let's say we have the availability of ibrutinib and venetoclax chemotherapy, is what does the patient want from the therapy? What's achievable for the patient? If you've got very bad heart disease or other problems, then you have to tailor what therapy can be given. And that those sorts of things are important. So it's very much a discussion with the patient, I think, in that context.
Yeah. And so this is the thing, isn't it? That there's a lot of complexity in what you're describing. And that's before we start involving things like infection risk, which of course is very topical at the moment. And many people are also told, unfortunately, by some doctors that they're not really at infection risk. And yet this is an immune disorder right from the beginning, as you explained, a tired immune system, I think was the words you used. And so it can be suddenly very shocking for someone. If, for example, they suddenly get a pneumonia or something like that happens and they go, oh, gosh, actually, or obviously with the recent news as well, actually, I have got a problem. And so there's a lot of complexity to the management of this condition that move beyond even just which drug to choose and when to give it and all of that. So I guess my question to you is, how important do you think it is for patients to be seen by somebody who really is an expert in CLL, who sees a lot of CLL patients, if you like? Because I did notice that one of the papers suggested that might be associated with longer life if you saw somebody who saw more patients with CLL. That was one of the findings, one of the epidemiological studies. So I don't know if you've got any comments on that.
Yeah, well, I think, first of all, the thing I'd add is uncertainty. So we've had a massive change in the treatment of CLL in the last 10 years. And because it's a slow disease and we see very good outcomes, there is uncertainty. Even the people who know all of the data and even the data that's not been published yet, trials are ongoing. We do trials because there's uncertainty and we don't have the answers. And so even someone like myself or someone who knows the data very well, we have to accept that we're making a judgment call on the information we have, and that may change, as we get more and more data. In terms of the specialists, I think patients should take, to some extent, ownership of their own disease. So I think... and I never have an issue with patients who are well informed, because it's much easier for me to have a discussion with a patient. That is also accepting that patients aren't doctors and not scientists necessarily, and they won't necessarily be able to analyse the data. So you have to have a relationship with your haematologist. Allows you to ask the questions and not feel that it's a stupid question or that you're being ignored. In terms of symptoms, whatever. That's an important sort of element of the relationship. I think most haematologists are experienced at treating CLL. I mean, there's a lot of information out there now, isn't there, on websites and patient webinars and patient groups. And I think it's a good thing to arm yourself with information, but not to the extent where that you're going to replace the haematologist. So no. I think trials are important. I mean, I'm a trialist, obviously, and I think you see new therapies in trials. And so one of the questions you should be asking as a patient is, is it a trial? And, if there isn't a trial, is there someone nearby that I should go to? Because generally the centres running trials are the ones who have a more sort of scientific sort of involvement in the disease, which is important for some people. I mean, but travelling 200 miles to see a specialist is not for everybody.
For sure.
I think it's a balance between that.
So you personally, in a year or in a month, let's say in a month, it might be a bit easier. How many people do you think you see with CLL, roughly?
So we have a big team in Leeds. So, we run a lot of clinical trials in CLL. It's one of our biggest areas. So we do clinics. We see some patients several times. So, if you're treatment, you're going to be seen every week with an anthrax, for example. But we see in my unit probably 150 to 100 patients a week with CLL or related diseases. One of the related diseases at that time. They're often repeated sort of patients. New patients, as in new to us or referred in to us, two or three a week probably we see with maybe more if you stage A patients with the whole team.
Yeah. So I guess that's an awful lot of people to sort of start to recognise patterns and start to learn a bit from the experience. And I guess that's a part of being a doctor that some people who aren't doctors don't perhaps understand, but actually the more you see of a particular condition, the more skilled you're going to get. I mean, it's, it's a bit like if you were having a car fixed, would you want to have a mechanic doing the task who was doing it for the first time or who maybe only saw 5 of that in a year versus somebody who sees 50 a month?
I think I have to say that the practice in the UK is haematologists looking after leukemia or leukemia, which is different to some other countries around the world. And actually, even in my time as a haematologist, even haematologists have become subspecialized. So that we now have haematologists who just look after leukemias or just look after lymphomas, really. In big district general hospitals, there'll be a subspecialization within haematologists. So most for a disease like CLL, most haematologists have a lot of experience of managing CLL. And there are obviously professional fora that involving myself, there's several of us in the UK. And I think I get a lot of emails and letters from other haematologists asking for advice over certain patients, particularly if there's something that's slightly out of the audience, like a very young patient or a patient with CLL. So we get a lot of informal referrals of that type that we would maybe advise from a distance. And if we had a trial, I might say, for example, say someone from the South Coast contacted me and said, we've got this patient. I might say to them, well, actually, we have a trial open for that. And I think it's open in these sites near you. Yeah. I did that recently with a patient downtown. And so it's about, you don't have to necessarily see the patient to have an influence on the decisions that are made.
So I guess then if someone is going to a local haematologist, they're happy with them, and they happen to know, I mean, they could even ask, I suppose, who do you work with? And what happens if I was needing treatment? Would I be able to get access to a trial? And if they would then say, well, actually, yeah, I'm good friends with, the guys in Leeds or the guys in London or wherever. And actually, yes, we're part of some sort of informal network or maybe even a formal. I've heard of some more local haematologists who actually join up with an MDT, a multidisciplinary team at a more specialist site remotely. And so those kinds of things happen as well, and I guess that would give you a bit of more confidence and encouragement that even if you don't necessarily see the top person, that there is access to that expertise for your care. Am I summarising that well?
I think that's fair. I think what I'd say is that there are various key parts to a patient's journey, and the first part is understanding the disease as much as you want to understand it as a patient. So, you know, I often draw, as patients have seen me, I draw pictures of CLL and they try and explain it in a way that people can understand. And I think it's really important that, that you know, that you understand the disease, that you, that if you want to understand the disease, and you have a relationship with your hematologist that allows you to ask questions, as I said. And that includes a wider clinical care specialist that we have, you know, we and trial nurses in our units that are very, you know, very important in terms of supporting our patients, because, you know, it's not easy to pick up the phone and ask Pete Hillman, you know, about COVID if you've only seen me once, whereas the nurse specialist are there and will feed it back. So it's a team, it's very much a team approach. So I think that's the first thing, is understanding. And then the second key aspect, so, you know, when treatment's being considered, you then need to ask the questions, you know, is it the right treatment? You know, is there a trial that could go into? You know, is there an opinion that you might get that may not take over your care, but actually would give you reassurance that you're getting the right treatment, especially in a time when treatments are evolving so rapidly, that, you know, you really want to get the right therapy. Now, some patients will be happy because they have a good relationship with the hematologist, that's fine. But I think you just have to be comfortable with the decisions that are being made.
That's really, really helpful, Peter. And I thought it might be good to split this into sort of two bits. Then this bit would probably be the longer bit and the second bit would be the shorter bit. So I think I might just pause it here for a moment.